If you're running a retail business, don't let disorganized order fulfillment cause chaos. Use ShipStation instead. From running a business out of your garage to multiple warehouses, ShipStation is ideal for every phase of your growth. Save time with one login for all your stores and by automating tasks, plus you'll get the best shipping rates from global carriers. Calm the chaos with the shipping software that delivers. Start a free trial at ShipStation.com/audio. That's ShipStation.com/audio.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and it's hard for me to believe that it is 2025 now. Feels like not that long ago that Adam and I had started this podcast at the end of 2015. And so we are entering into our 10th year. At the end of this year, it'll be 10 years officially that you know, this podcast has been out in the universe. And so I still remember the first day that we released that first episode of What is Deconstruction in the basement of my old house. We've come a long way since then, hopefully. Adam and I were just hanging out the other night and laughing about the fact that we can't go back and listen to the early episodes without cringing. And yet people seem to love some of the early ones. So thank you guys so much. Had a really fun time the other night, by the way, chatting through Facebook Messenger through the group with some listeners. Some were new and some have been around since the very beginning, which is crazy to think about. So thank you guys so much, whether you're a new listener or a listener who's been around since the very beginning. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for being here. So hopefully what we're doing here is still helpful and hopefully you still enjoy the content I'm putting out there. And Adam says hello. So with that having been said, welcome you back for part two of my interview with Dr. Garrick V. Allen. And if you heard that, that is my new dog barking in the background. Yes, we rescued a doggy and he's very sweet, but very mischievous. So sorry about that. Anyway, we'd like to keep it live here. You know, if you want to stay up on top of everything that we're up to, www.thedeconstructionist.org is our website. And we have everything on there from our blog, our web store, which now has international shipping, and of course, our entire back catalog that you can stream for free directly from the website. So check it out. But let's get to it. Without further ado, I give you Garrick V. Allen.
Tell me what made us think.
So yeah, I always feel really bad for the Catholic epistles.
It's interesting you bring that up. I just recently interviewed John Dominic Crossan again.
Oh, okay.
And he's got a book on Paul coming out, or may have come out already, called Paul the Pharisee.
And nice.
Look specifically at, you know, at Paul's role in the early Christian church. So it's kind of interesting you brought that up. But talk about the fact that, like, because you also mentioned lists, and I had a question written down about that as well, because, you know, between, as you said, prefaces, prologues, and lists, all of these things signify some level of importance to the things that they're pointing at by the person who's providing this commentary. Talk a little bit about that. And also, you give an example of how over the centuries people have written sort of their questions, thoughts, and experiences into the margins of not just the Bible, but books in general. This is sort of a common practice, which I think probably most people listening can remember, if not themselves doing it, but relatives' books. I've got a copy of an old Bible from the 1800s. I mean, not old, I guess, comparatively.
That's pretty old. That's old enough. Yeah.
Yeah. That's got all sorts of notes in it, dedication notes in the very front. And just so you can tell what verses they were really interested in just by virtue of like underlines and notes off to the margin. That was really a big thing because you share a lot of photos of some of these ancient manuscripts in the book. And there's everything from like doodles to really bad artwork, all sorts of stuff in there.
Yeah. There's a lot of good artwork too, but I like the funky stuff that people tend to avoid. I mean, the first thing I'll say is, in spaces where there's not many books, in most of these communities, the biblical texts are going to be fairly important. And so they're the things that people are going to use. And it's the thing that you know will probably outlive you. People will repair it, pass it on. And it's a space where you can leave a little part of yourself, whether in an intentional way or a silly way. And so the New Testament's manuscripts are full of these funky annotations, pictures of people with underbites, or a picture of Jesus with really tiny little hands, or like Don't ships work. And monasteries. I know. I mean, they're very cool stuff. Like little, there's a whole set of little doodles that I have no other word for except like weird little guys, like a guy, a triangle with a little head and someone's foot, a sort of angel's wings, you know, all these sorts of things appear everywhere. There's one manuscript that's at the Monastery of St. John the Theologian on Patmos that has two people fighting in the margins, people shooting at each other, shooting bows and arrows, and these sorts of things. So people use these in their sort of everyday lives. I mean, the other thing you see a lot of is people learning to write the alphabet by copying the letters on the page and writing alpha, beta, gamma, so on in the margins, or trying to do some of the scribal flourishes that you see and writing these over and over and over and over again, or copying the first line of a page 5 or 6 times to do these sorts of things. So these are spaces where people learn to do human things, to read and write, not only for like spiritual sustenance and liturgy and so on, but it's an interesting sociological thing. And it's not surprising that Bibles of all types and manuscripts of the New Testament are the places where people play these things out. They write prayers in the margins. There's a manuscript in Dublin I really like, a gospel manuscript where a guy called Peter the Shoemaker prays for his wife Anastasia and their children in the lower margins of Luke. So you see like little bits of people's lives kind of deposited in these spaces. And then, you know, like more intellectually or scholarly, you have a lot of lists. I mean, they're everywhere. Dozens and dozens and dozens of lists that do different things, that list out Jesus's miracles or the patriarchs or the write the Ten Commandments again, or one that's really prevalent are lists of quotations. I mean, if you've read the New Testament in any serious way, you know that it is constantly quoting parts of Jewish scripture, the Old Testament, throughout. And people make lists of these things and catalog where these quotations come from and mark them in the margins so you can see, again, the broader network between different parts of scripture that are kind of in conversation with one another. Or before chapter and verses existed, people had chapter lists, a different set of chapters than we have today for each book. And these often appear at the front with little titles telling you what each section is about and so on. And these lists go on for pages and pages and pages at the front. So these things are just everywhere. So like these residues of intellectual engagement with the Bible that then forces you to look for those features in the text as you read. And also the sort of daily life, ubiquitous, everyday, playing in the margins, doing normal human things with these sacred texts, I think is a really beautiful expression of the way that human activity influences, preserves, transmits these sacred texts. And you can see these are not like objects that are necessarily untouchable or unchangeable. People are always manipulating them and doing things with them along the way.
Yeah, it's just a really cool way to historically sort of helps you kind of understand the people in that time period and how they interacted with the text as well, and like what things that they thought were important to them in that particular moment in time. It's kind of this cool insight that we don't get in our, like I said, our very kind of sterilized versions of the Bible we have today, you know?
Yep. I mean, actually, I mean, it puts our own reading we do with the Bible today, what, you know, wherever we're at in faith, no faith, deconstructing, whatever, you can read a biblical text and see yourself as part of a biblical story. It gives you context for the things you're doing, shows that you're not the first person to not understand what this passage is about or what this part of the text is or why this weird thing here matters, or how it relates to other parts of the Bible. So it really gives us some leeway, I think, to give ourselves the space and the time to engage these texts however we need to at that moment and see ourselves as part of a much bigger story that goes all the way back to the first century that we have just these tiny little traces of. I tried to think of the Bible as a film that's been going on since the first century. And every time you see a manuscript or you pick up a modern Bible today, you get a real good frame of the film. But there's a lot of black parts, a lot of obscure parts. And so trying to find your way within that bigger narrative is something that we do every time we pick up a Bible.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that we touched on that I would like to just talk a little bit more about is that we kind of references the role of titles. And you mentioned the book as well. You know, there is a specific role for the use of a title, you know, especially in these types of manuscripts.
Absolutely. Oh man, I love titles. We have a project here where we've digitally edited every form of every title in every Greek New Testament manuscript. We have over 30,000 annotations. It's been a big 5-year project. We're nearly done, but I spent a lot of time looking at titles in the manuscripts as a result. But I mean, we see really interesting things. You know, the way that we know these books, with the titles we know these books by today, you find them in the manuscripts, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and so on. But you also find a whole range of other titles. So the book of Revelation has over 50 different titles in Greek alone. They're all kind of a kind, but they give different descriptions to John or locate him on Patmos or talk about what an apocalypse is. There's also a set of titles that we don't normally have in our, at least English books anymore, called the subscription or titles at the end of a book. And often in the manuscripts, these show us a lot of information. They give us a sort of imagined context for how to think of the book. So for Matthew, it's something like, you know, the book of Matthew written 8 years after Jesus' ascension in Jerusalem in Hebrew. Now, scholars don't think any of that is right. Like Matthew was not written in the 40s. It was written much later. It was certainly not written in Hebrew and probably not in Jerusalem. But it gives you a context for understanding how people have read that book. And if you think it's very early, you read the things that Jesus says about Jerusalem in a different way. You approach the text in an entirely different framework. And so these titles do a lot of work of setting the parameters, particularly since like the Gospels are anonymous. Like the texts themselves don't tell us who the author is. They don't care. But Paul does in most of the letters, but a lot of the letters are anonymous. You know, Hebrews is entirely anonymous. But these titles give attribute authorship, so they give you a character to think about in their context and what they're writing, and it gives you the space to consider these works within a broader historical or chronological context or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's really important to note. And the other thing that's important to note, I think, is the fact that you mentioned that a lot of these are anonymous, even though I think we take for granted that they've always been associated with a particular author, and that was not always the case. That was a later, I think, adaptation, right? Of like 4th century or so.
I think it's a bit early. I think it's for the Gospels, it's probably 2nd century, would be my guess. I think it's quite early. I don't think the people who wrote the Gospels then turned around and wrote Gospel According to Mark at the top of it. You know, these are the products of tradition. These are the products of early Christian communities trying to contextualize what to do with these four books. And when you can attach them to particular personalities, that gives you context to think about them in different ways, to separate them off from one another, to give them their own independent existences, and to kind of foreclose the continuing development of Gospels at that stage, putting them together in a nice corpus of four, which does a lot of like symbolic work for you. So people are trying to shape these texts from the earliest stage, but none of this stuff comes from the authors themselves.
Wow. See, that's funny. It's something that we've talked about in the podcast before. So, but you know, that's one of those things that we kind of like fight or wrestle with specifically within Western culture in the United States. So like everyone has been convinced, you know, that, oh, these have always been attributed to, you know, Matthew or Mark or you know, whoever. That's just not the case. So,
nope. I mean, I think with Paul's letters, you can trace the majority of them to Paul himself. I think there's a good case there. But, you know, we think about authorship as like the great genius writing a book. But in antiquity, even today, but also in antiquity, like writing a book is a communal project. It's your family's time resources to give you space to do this, your coworkers and the people who read drafts and the publishers and whoever. Like this is all a collaborative process. So even if Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John is, you know, responsible for the Gospels in one way or another, there's a whole range of other people out there enslaved people, servants, you know, whoever who had a hand in shaping these texts that we have today.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good. Talk a little bit about towards the end of the book, you talk about the role of corrections. So like the fixing of mistakes, the making corrections in these texts, but also just the common practice in general. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that you see in, I would say, almost every manuscript of the New Testament we have are corrections where people, either the first scribe who was responsible for copying out the text, or later correctors or later readers, have changed the text in some way. So often this is fixing just normal mistakes. So a word, you spelled a word wrong, you put it in the wrong case or whatever. Or people in some instances correct the text to another manuscript, which may have a slightly different version of that text. And you do this because in an age before computers or word processing software, you either had, if you make a mistake, you either have to throw away the entire page and get a new one and start afresh, or make a small scale correction. And almost everyone chose the latter. So, you know, some of our earliest, most important manuscripts like Codex Sinaiticus have thousands of corrections by multiple different people. The earliest copy of Paul's letters in Dublin has dozens of corrections made by three or four different people. So you can see like people not only actively reading, but engaging like the details of the text, smoothing things, crossing things out, adding things that have been forgotten. I think the vast majority of the time, these are just scribal mistakes, but other times they're like textually significant. And what's interesting is in most cases, they give people who are reading the manuscript that has been corrected options. Like you can read the same passage in two ways because both readings are there, are visible to you. So it's like reading a novel where the author has gone through and changed a bunch of stuff throughout, but you see everything that they've done, both the original and the changed version. So it's actually a very cool experience of trying to work your way through some of these pages and see what happens if you follow this reading but not that one, or this one but not that one, and try to make sense of what happened in this manuscript. What were people trying to do? Why would someone do this? And to what end? You know, so these are the sorts of things that corrections give us a chance to explore. Like, it's not only modern text critics who are interested in these things. People from the very earliest manuscripts we have were interested to engage the small scale details of these texts, and we have the residues of their work.
Yeah, I think that's the coolest part is you can actually see, it's almost like, you know, my daughter right now is getting into ever more complex math, which I am no help. Their system that they're teaching now is completely different than what I grew up with. But the commonality there is that they have to show their work, you know, to see how they
exactly
arrived at the conclusion. Yep. And to see some of the thought process behind that, which is really cool.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fun to see the results of someone engaging their sacred text so carefully that they changed what they had before them, either based on some other thing they knew, some other manuscript they had before them. But it's fun to see people actually, like you said, showing their work and then giving us access to it is a very cool thing. So I think there's a lot more work to be done with this just because there's so many manuscripts, there's so many corrections. It would take you years to catalog all the corrections in some of these manuscripts. So there's a lot of work to be done in this space.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you've got the complications of the fact that obviously, you know, New Testament specifically was written in Greek, completely different language, for yep. which aren't always like for like words between when you're translating, you know, between Greek and like English or any number of other languages.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it gets even trickier and kind of goes back to, you know, Jacques Derrida, where we kind of stole our name from, who talks about, yeah. you know, how text loses meaning, you know, by the second, the further removed it is from the source. So, you know,
absolutely. But these sorts of things, and I think in my mind, bring meaning back to the text when you engage it in this way. When you look at the paratext, you see people trying to bring life and vitality to this tradition that they've received. It's in the changing that you do that. I've never understood anything that Derrida has ever written, but I think he would like that idea. So I hope so anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know we're getting close to time here, but I wondered if you could kind of leave listeners with what's kind of your hope of that people take away from the book and sort of maybe helping us to understand the New Testament a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my hope for the book is that it gives people the freedom to think about what the Bible is for themselves. So, you know, as a kid growing up, you know, be accidentally involved in an evangelical church as a high schooler, you learn lots of things. The Bible is the unchanging word of God. It's very clear and easy to understand. But every time I read it, I didn't feel that way. So I hope it gives people permission to take those feelings and do something with them. You know, even if you don't read Greek or, you know, you can't go to the British Library to see a manuscript, you know, these things are online. They're very accessible. You can flip through and, you know, try to find some of these features as you're looking around. But I hope it gives people a renewed interest in considering what the Bible is in light of how other people have made it available to us. I mean, our modern Bibles don't exist without these manuscripts, without the scholarly work that turns these manuscripts and their texts into critical editions, without the people who then translate those editions into our modern Bibles. So it helps you to get behind the printed book on your shelf, to get behind the scholarly tools we use to do interpretation, and get back to the very most primary sources that we have for these traditions that have been important to people for 2,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really neat, and it points out a lot of things that I think, like I said at the top, that we take for granted that when reading our modern Bible, like, we don't consider in terms of how it sort of guides us and steers us in our understanding of the passage that we're reading. And even the fact that we have chapters and verses, those didn't always even exist in the form that they exist today. It's like little things like that that you don't even think about.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. We consider chapters and verses an ingrained part of what the Bible is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, some publishers put out Bibles without chapters and verses. People tend not to like them very much because these paratexts makes the Bible the Bible. And the same is true for these other things we've been talking about in the manuscripts. Like, good paratexts, you don't even notice them. They're hidden in plain sight. They're everywhere, but nowhere at the same time. And you take on what they're wanting to tell you without even thinking about it. So when we are aware of these things, it changes the way not only you read the Bible, but a lot of other things. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. I haven't been able to anyway, but it's been really generative for my scholarly work, for this book, which is trying to, you know, cash out some of these implications for real people who are reading these texts in different ways. And, you know, I hope people can look at all the nice pictures and start to see what's out there.
Yeah, I love that part, by the way. It's one of the things that I loved about, you know, I mentioned John Dominic Crossan earlier. He did this really cool book on the resurrection at Easter years ago that is filled with, you know, pictures of frescoes and stuff. And I think it, as a visual guy, I love that.
Yeah.
And so your book felt the same way. You put really cool pictures of these manuscripts throughout. So not only describing them, but showing sort of like, you know, some of the crazy doodles, for example, was really a neat experience. So tell people where they can get a copy of the book and also where they should go to stay up on top of what you're up to.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can find the book on any place that sells books, Amazon, anywhere else you buy your books online, most bookstores. So keep a lookout. You can look up if you are interested in my scholarly work, you can find that at the University of Glasgow website by looking me up right there. I'm also just moved from Twitter to Blue Sky. So you can find me on Blue Sky, and yeah, I'm around.
Awesome. Yep. We just started an account on Blue Sky as well.
Nice.
Twitter's been a little weird. It's always been very angry too, which I've never
liked. Yeah. Gotten significantly worse. It's time to jump ship.
Yeah, absolutely. And Blue Sky has all the best features of the old Twitter, I think, too.
Breath of fresh air.
Yeah. So absolutely. So I'll put all those links in the show notes. So folks, go out and follow. And like I said, grab a copy of the book. It's absolutely fascinating. I can't recommend it enough. And thank you so much for coming on again. Really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thanks for your time.
Does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care? His face must look like yours. Did God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God that looks like us. Does God know my name? Is the ache in my soul just confined to my brain? Even so, it's not real. So take a breath, breathe it in. The mystery that is this, a universe we don't know. But I think the truth is, if God has a face, her face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. Face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill H. and E., even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face. Take a breath, breathe it in. The mystery that is this universe we don't know. But I think the truth is, if God has a face, a face must look. If God has a face, the face it must be yours.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.